Okay, thank you. So the purpose of this series of three talks is to explain the relationship between three basic concepts. First, the condition numbers. So we already have an introduction on the subject this morning by Felipe. Then I want to relate this to the complexity of path following methods for to solve polynomial system of equations. Okay, and my purpose is not to go through the last results obtained recently, for example by Carlos Beltran and Luis Miguel Pardo, or by Peter Burgisser and Felipe Cooker. They are here and they will speak about that subject. I want mainly to go through the mainstream of ideas who during 20 years made this subject evolving. I won't speak neither about implementations. So there are people who are specialized on that subject, for example T.Y. Lee or Somis, Wampler, and so on. So just I want to relate this condition number to the complexity issues on this polynomial system solving problem. So there will be this talk is divided in six parts, six sections. I will speak on mainly on the two first sections today. And I want to explain a little bit the geometry of which is behind all these problems. And in the first lecture, I will give the general principles of continuation methods and also the numerical counterpart, these predictor-corrector methods. And I will explain how we can relate the complexity of such method to the condition number. So I have to start with a certain number of notations. We are considering system of homogeneous polynomials, equations. So the system is a map from C to the n plus 1. So we have n plus 1 homogeneous variables, and the polynomials are homogeneous, and we have n equations. Each equation, Fi, has a degree Di, exactly, since they are homogeneous. And the standard notation for such polynomials is something like that, or in a concentrated form, here we use this notation. Alpha is a multi-index. Okay. In this space, we need an inner product. We need an inner product to measure so the distance and the angles. And the inner product we choose is the product structure here. We have the sum of these inner products for the different equations, which is given by this classical sum with this ponderation. This multinomial coefficient here is the inverse of a multinomial coefficient corresponds. There is another way to write this scalar product here. I prefer it to look at the integral at the L2 integral on the sphere. Okay, we can define the scalar product of two equation, two, excuse me, two polynomials. I have to remember this limit, Figi, as the integral of f of z, Fi of z, Gi of z, on the sphere. We need a bar here, and the sphere, it's a sphere in the space, which one? N plus 1 with radius 1. And we obtain exactly this scalar product modulo a certain constant here, and I forget exactly what is it. So this is important because the scalar product here seems to be a little bit mysterious, but when you look at it like that, you see immediately this unitary invariance. So that is the scalar product of the composition by unitary transformations is invariant. Now I have to introduce the solution variety. We place an important role here. Associated with the polynomial system solving. So this is simply described here. This is simply the set of pairs f zeta, with f is a polynomial system and zeta is a root. So let me draw it, and I will use this drawing during my talk. So here we have the same of systems. It's P of HD. HD. Yeah, but after that I will I will do it. But I need. So here we have the space of systems. Okay. So this is the projective space associated with the space HD. And here we have the space of solutions, P of C to the n plus 1. Okay? And the solution variety is a set of pairs. So it is part of the graph here, something like that. It's not easy to. Okay. And coming like that, so I skip this line. This is my solution variety, B. And if I take a point here, this is a pair f zeta. So f is somewhere here in the base space. We have f. This is our polynomial system, and here somewhere we have zeta. Okay, and we project it. We have two projections, one from V to F into the space of systems, and the other one by two, it's a projection onto the space of solutions. This is a picture. So we take here projective spaces instead of vector spaces because we consider only homogeneous problems. So if we have a root, multiple of the root is also a root. That means a point in the corresponding projective space. And it's the same with the problem. So if we multiply a system by a scalar, we obtain exactly the same root. So this solution variety is a submanifold, that is something smooth. We can make computation on it easily, and its dimension is exactly the dimension of the base space. Okay, typically above a point, so this surface has the same dimension as this space, and above a system, generically, we have only a finite number of points corresponding to the different routes. Another important concept is the concept of well-posed. Problem is well-posed. This is when the multiplicity is 1, it's defined here by this condition. The rank of the derivative of f at zeta is equal to n. Okay. Another way to say that is to consider the projection. A problem is well posed. This is equivalent to say that f is a regular value of the projection pi 1. That means the derivative of pi 1 at the pair f zeta has a maximum rank. So since both spaces, the tangent space at v at f zeta and the space p of hd have the same dimension, that is to say that the derivative of pi 1 is an isomorphism between the two spaces. Okay? Otherwise, we say that the problem is ill-posed. So I told you the derivative is an isomorphism, the derivative of pi 1. But you can see that for certain systems here, we have a tangent vertical plane like that, and so that creates a kernel for the derivative of this first projection. So such problems here are imposed. Here you have also imposed problems here. And the set of these imposed instances are is called the critical variety. Okay? So we have here the critical variety. And when you project this critical variety on the base space here, you obtain some systems here, you have some systems here, other much more here, and the projection of this critical variety here is discriminant variety. And we call it sigma, and here sigma prime. Okay? This will play an important role later. So this is, for the moment, the picture. I guess you can see it here. So I already defined it, and here is the picture. So as you can see, it's the same. So no problem. So now, what can we do? What is our objective? Is to solve a system. So this system is given somewhere here. It's our system we want to solve is this F1 we have here, and for that we consider a path, a smooth path connecting a given system F0. I take here a very easy system with a given solution, and we want to connect this system F0 to a target system F1 by a path that is a curve in the space of systems depending on the parameter t. T varies between 0 to 1. And we want to follow so this path of systems, and at the same time to follow a curve of solutions. How can we do that? So, theoretically, in a theoretical point of view, we are given here a path. Here it's just a segment in the space of systems. And we also have this solution, zeta zero. So we know exactly F0, zeta zero, and this path. This is our data. And I suppose that this path here do not cut the discriminant variety. In that case, according to the implicit function theorem, I can lift the path here into a path inside the solution variety. And there is a unique path here in this solution variety corresponding to the path here and starting at this zeta zero. And I want to follow this curve here in the solution variety to reach zeta one. Zeta one is my objective. How to do that? In practice, we need an algorithm, and this algorithm is based on a predictor-corrector method. So we start by a discretization of the interval. That means instead of the time, of the continuous time, t, we take a certain number of a finite number of t0, t1, etc., tk. And instead of the path, we will approximate this continuous path here by a finite number of pairs, fti, zeta, zti, which is no more inside the solution variety. Zti will be an approximation of zeta ti. So it's not in the solution variety, but just around. And how to do that? We use a classical strategy which is called predictor-corrector method. And I have to explain that. So, we have here our different instances, ft1, ft2, ftk, which is our f1. And we know exactly this pair here, okay? We now want to compute an approximation zt1 of this zeta t1. What do? We take zeta 0, so this the previous computed solution, here it's the exact solution, or an approximation, nobody cares about that, and we correct this, we have a correction step in order to obtain a zt1 close enough to zeta t1. And from zt1, we take this as a prediction about the value we want to compute zeta, the approximation of zeta t2 corresponding to the system ft2. We take this zt1 as a predictor, and we correct this value, etc. And we try, by this way, to follow this curve approximately in a finite number of steps. And so, if things go well, and in that case, if the TI are close enough, if we have enough TIs and if they are close enough, the corresponding pairs will create an approximation, a good approximation of the exact values zeta TI. And the number of steps we need to obtain this result will be the complexity of the process. Okay? So we measure this complexity by the number k of steps we need. Now how to do that? We consider here, since we are in a homogeneous context, in projective spaces, we consider the projective Newton operator. And starting from this predictor ZTI, we correct it in using the Newton, projective Newton operator applied to the system FTI plus 1. And this will give us this ZT1. Okay? Just one step of Newton corresponding of to the new system. And this operator is defined, it's more or less the same definition as in the affine case, where you take the value f of z multiplied, you applied to this vector the inverse of the derivative, and the Newton operator is defined by this way. Here we have a slight modification because df is a linear map from c to the n plus 1 into c to the n, and so we restrict this operator to the tangent space at z in the projective space Pn of c. And this tangent space is maybe identified to the orthogonal to z. We remark that if we multiply x by a scalar, lambda, we obtain the same modification for the Newton operator here. So in fact, this NF doesn't depend on x, but just on the line, that is on the corresponding projective point. So this is well defined. Now we want to stay close. We want to stay close here from this curve. And I have to define this. What does that mean? What does that mean to be close enough? ZTI from zeta TI. And this is a concept I have to introduce. So we say that a certain x0 in the projective space is an approximate zero of f, of the system f, with actual zero zeta, when the Newton sequence defined, as I explained in the previous slide, converges immediately and quadratically to zeta. Doesn't work anymore. Yes, it works. That is, what does that mean immediately quadratically? That means we have this estimate. And so this is a convergence very fast, since we are going to zero as fast as this sequence here. The distance we use here is a classical distance in projective spaces, that is, the angle made by two lines. In fact, for certain reasons, we take here the sign of this angle, which is also a distance on the projective space. And now we need a criterion to say this is an approximate zero. Okay? And this criterion is given by this inequality here. X will be an approximate zero of a system F with actual zero zeta as soon as the distance of X from zeta is less than or equal to this quantity. This quantity involves a certain gamma, which is defined here. It involves the norm of these multilinear maps involving the successive derivatives of the system F. Notice that here in our case, the supremum is a maximum since we are in a polynomial case, but we can extend this definition to analytic functions. So this is the reason why I left this supremum. And this quantity is also well defined in the projective space. Any scaling on F or zeta doesn't change the gamma. So we now have to, things are much more precise. We have quantified the proximity of an approximation to the actual root. And what we want to do now during our process is to stay inside this tube around the path with size given by this number. It's a 3 minus square root of 7 divided by 2 gamma. I forgot the 2 here. It corresponds so to each ft zeta t, we have an admissible interval here, and we have to stay inside this tube. And if we can realize this program, in that case, we have approximate zero of the different considered systems, and we can compute the actual zero quadratically with a very performant algorithm. So this is what we want to do, to stay inside this tube. Now, I have to introduce a condition number, so relatively to the problem considered here. That is a condition number associated with such problems. Polynomial equations, homogeneous polynomial systems, and roots of such systems. So, consider here a well-posed problem. That is, we are not in the critical variety. In that case, the derivative of this projection is an isomorphism. And consequently, I can apply the inverse function theorem or the implicit function theorem. I can locally, around F, invert the map pi 1. Okay? And it will map this onto a certain neighborhood here in V. So I have here an inverse pi 1 minus 1, but it's related to this pair. Okay? And then I can project here on 2 pi 2. And so I have a map from this neighborhood here onto a certain neighborhood here, which is in fact the solution map. This is a solution map around F zeta. Okay? So we have the existence of such a map. And so this map, it's, we cannot compute it, otherwise the problem is already solved and there is nothing to do. But we define, so I want to define the condition number of the problem, the considered problem at F zeta. This condition number here will be the norm of the derivative of the solution map at the instance F zeta. Okay? This number, this is an operator norm. So this is what I call mu of F zeta. This operator norm measures the maximum size of the variations of the solution map in terms of the variations of the data. Okay? Here, since we are in projective spaces, everything is scaled, and we make a certain number of computations, and we obtain this number here. Here, this is an operator norm, so this is the classical operator norm. This is a diagonal matrix involving the norm of the root to the DI. The DI has the degrees of the different equations. And we have to define on HD an Hermitian structure to define all these norms, and it is given by precisely the Hermitian structure I defined previously. So, and we will see tomorrow that we can relate this condition number here to the distance of this set in a certain meaning. This will be made more precise tomorrow. I don't want to say more today. So the last step before reaching our objective is given by the following estimate. We relate the gamma. The gamma measures the size of the tube around the path we want to follow, blah blah blah, and this gamma is related to the condition number by this estimate. Gamma is less than d to the square divided by 2 multiplied by mu. What does that mean? That means that when we have, when the instance here, the condition number is big, 1 over gamma is small. Okay? And the tube we have to follow is a very tiny tube. And to follow this, to stay close to the curve we want to follow, we need a lot of steps. So if we are close to ill-posed problems, this will slow our algorithm and increase the complexity. So this is made precise by the following theorem due to Schubenzmehl in a paper called Bayes 1. Given a path FT in the space of systems and which do not cut the discriminant variety sigma and the zero zeta zero, so this creates a unique curve in the set of in the solution map, there exists a subdivision T0 TK of the interval 0, 1 such that each zeta TI constructed by the Newton predictor corrector algorithm is an approximate zero of TI with actual zero zeta TI. So the program is satisfied, and the complexity, what is important here, is to see that this complexity K is related to the degree d. D is the maximum degree of the different equations. So this is a number we know. We know this number. C is a constant. It's something like 20 or 20.5. Don't know. LF. LF is the length of the path inside the space of systems. So this is something we know. We can compute it, and even in the case of a linear path, we can give estimates, we can give bounds for this number, but there is still this mu f, and mu f is a supremum of the condition numbers of the instances ft zeta t we have along the curve in the solution variety. Okay, so the main ingredient in this estimate is the main ingredient in the bound for the complexity k is the square of this condition number. The sparse case. So, long time ago, I tried to see if a sparse system is easier to solve than a non-sparse one. So, I asked people, I said to T. Wiley, what do you mean? Is it easier? He said, yes. But we have no proof of that, in fact. No proof. So I wanted to consider this problem. And so I will consider here two cases. The case of finomials. So that is the case of polynomial systems where a lot of monomials are zero. We have a few number of non-zero monomials. Also the case of polynomial equations depending on the small number of parameters. For example, typically, this, if you develop this expression, this is not a finomial, but it depends only on two parameters, A and B. So can we do the same story that before, and what do we obtain? I don't want to say everything again, but I will consider here first a submanifold in P of HD corresponding to sparse, certain sparse structure or certain typical systems defined by certain parameters. And I will suppose that K is a submanifold of small dimension in the space of systems. And to this submanifold, we can associate a sparse solution variety. And to this, and then we can also define a sparse condition number, mu k. How do we do that? Exactly in the same way. But instead of considering shear perturbations in the space of systems, we will consider only perturbations in the space of sparse systems, that is in a submanifold. But we have the same map. So when you take this operator norm, this is a supremum on the perturbations you make. If you decrease the set, you decrease the bound. So the sparse condition number is smaller. Okay? This, we have here the definition, the same definition for the two condition number. But in the second case, the perturbation f dot are taken in a subspace of this one. And so the second supremum is smaller. I studied few examples. It's very difficult to study examples in such frame. But I have an example where this sparse condition number, it's exponentially smaller than this one. And it corresponds to finomials in one variable. Very particular case. In that case, we have the same complexity result as in Bezout 1, except that In the previous theorem, we had mu to the square here. Here we are mu multiplied by mu sparse, mu sub k. So there is an improvement. Is this, what can we say more? I don't know. This is a problem to study much precisely this bound, but there is difficulty, a serious difficulty, is to study on the average the distribution. It's to study the distribution of this number when we take when we put a probability measure on the space of system. And this is not really easy. And so, for the sparse case, I won't say more. So, in fact, you have to enter into the details, but mu k times LF here gives a bound for this curve. The length of the curve we have here in the. And this mu here depends on the gamma. The gamma is. I introduce it in the Newton method. Yeah, you are right. It will be the length in the solution variety. Okay. I have to cite the reference I used to for this first talk. First of all, I spoke a lot about this paper, Complexity of Bayesian Theorem 1. By Shub and Smail, and published in 1993, so it was a paper, the job was done a few years before. For the sparse polynomial systems, I cite this paper, I think it has been presented in a conference, probably in Park City, something like that. This is a remote place in Utah. Some people remember that all the liquor stores were without wine after the conference. And also the book by Blum, Cooker, Shub and Smail. That's it for today.